Welcome to Sex with Simmery. Frank, occasionally explicit edutainment on the most important topic of all. Sex with Simmery is not intended for children and is not safe for work unless your boss is particularly awesome. See more at sexwithtimmery.com.
Welcome to Sex with Simmery. This is Dr. Timmery. And I'm just so excited to introduce today's guest, Dr. Nerdlove. How you doing?
Great. How are you?
I'm fantastic. So, doctor, are you a doctor? Is that a real thing?
Well, I've got a $20 certificate that I got off the internet that says I am, but it says I'm a doctor of metaphysics.
Ooh, okay. That's kind
of
like...
So I'm a genuine fake doctor.
Cool. That's kind of like how I think I can officiate weddings, because I think I filled out one of those things, like, back in 1998. So if you ever need, you know, an officiant, you can hit me up, too.
I think that's the same place where I got my fake doctorate, so I think, yeah.
Fake doctorate in metaphysics. Like, Did you have to do anything for that, or just like sign your name and date?
Apparently the Universal Life Church does have a couple where you actually have to like fill out tests and write papers, and it was like, you know, too much work for what's really just kind of a gag nickname that friends of mine gave me. So I just said, "All right, here's $20," and they sent me a doctorate that means absolutely nothing.
Sweet. I mean, I know people who have doctorates that I don't think it means anything either. So that's cool. I'm just gonna put that there.
Yeah, it's one of my taglines is, remember, Dr. Nerdlove is not really a doctor.
Cool. Well, there are plenty of people with PhDs that aren't, you know, whatever. I trust you. Anyway, so the reason I'm excited to have you on is because I actually really just like your shit. And you fill a niche in the sexuality education advicey sort of. I don't know if that's a correct description of what you do. What would you like to describe what you do?
Somewhere between the dating coach and just a nosy advice blogger who just likes to run off at the mouth, really.
Yeah,
it's really just trying to fill in a niche, because it seems that there isn't much out there for legit love and relationship advice for guys, whereas there's entire industries designed for women. And whether, you know, you can argue whether or not any of it's any good. I mean, like books like Think Like a Man, Act Like a Lady reinforce a lot of old-fashioned gender roles, and so that, you know, kind of a question of its utility, but at least they're out there. For guys, there really isn't much if you're not good at relationships, but you want to get better. And the only other group out there that really kind of answers that question is the pickup community. And while there's a lot good to be learned from them, that there's also a lot of really negative attitudes, especially towards sex, sexuality, and women, that can really kind of poison your mind while you're doing it.
I like that you bring that up, because, I mean, those are exactly specifically the reasons why I'm a big fan of you. Why do you think that there is this dearth of information? I mean, I had noticed for a long time that most sexuality bloggers, sexuality advice people, you know, et cetera, TV folks, tend to be either women or tend to be gay men. And, you know, just very... very confusing for me from the outside, because it seems like men tend to be the experts, you know, that get predominance in most things. So what is this about?
It really, I think a lot of it comes down to views of masculinity. Our culture really teaches us that men are either good at relationships or completely hopeless at them, and there's no real in between. It's sort of a binary state. And if you admit that you're bad at them but want to get better, you kind of get mocked for it. And everyone, like, when you see somebody who's, say, buying a copy of Neil Strauss's The Game at Barnes & Noble, you kind of give them a side eye and go, loser. Because it's shameful to admit that, yes, I'm bad with women. But it's also, well, okay, good, but how does one improve? How do you just stumble around in the dark and hope you just magically find the formula? Or do you treat it like I advocate, treating it like a skill? And if it's a skill, then it's really no different than, say, wanting to get better at playing basketball or speak a foreign language.
So in some ways, that is sort of what like a men's health or something like that does kind of try to do, to integrate it into the, you know, it's also like learning how to train your dog and how to work out and eat and that sort of thing. And it's just all casually like that, but those experts, again, it still tends to reinforce really traditional stuff most of the time.
Yeah, and a lot of it isn't necessarily useful. I mean, everyone likes to say, you know, hey, you know, be yourself, okay, great. What if it's being yourself that's the problem?
Okay, it's a valid point.
I mean, if you're like, not to say that if you're bad with women, you have to change everything about you, but sometimes there are a lot of times where it's something you're doing that's actively holding you back. Like maybe you're coming off as excessively negative, or you're not comfortable at dealing with people, so maybe you're coming off a little bit creepy without meaning to.
So I'm really glad you brought up the C word, the creep word, because I think that has like an incredible amount of power, and that the application of the term creep onto a guy carries the same sort of stigma and baggage and extra scariness as like, you know, cunt or slut might onto a woman. So I'm really glad you brought up that whole concept.
Yeah, and it gets to be an interesting discussion, because whenever you bring up creep online or guys being creepy, there will always be this sudden outpouring of people who are complaining. It's like, I'm not creepy. I just, women don't find me attractive. Handsome guys aren't creepy. And it ties into like the Saturday Night Live Tom Brady sexual harassment sketch, where don't want to be accused of sexual harassment, just be handsome. And that's not really how it works, because there's a difference between attractive and attracted. Someone you are attracted to making an advance is making an advance that is welcomed. But just because they're aesthetically pleasing doesn't necessarily mean that you want anything to do with them. Brad Pitt's a good-looking guy, but if he comes up and hits on you and you're saying, no, go away, and he keeps hitting on you, that's going to be creepy no matter how good-looking he is.
So it's about it's about specific behaviors.
Exactly. Being a creep means that you're making someone feel uncomfortable. So one of the things that I see a lot of guys do, and I did this myself back in the bad old days, is you may be a little nervous to go up and talk to someone because she's with her friends, and you don't really want to try to go talk with them in front of their friends because, you know, it's going to be harder. Their friends, maybe they're going to make fun of you. Maybe they're going to interfere or whatever. So you just hang around and just kind of wait for your opportunity. But while you're hanging around just waiting for her to catch her alone, which when you say it like that, sure, it sounds creepy in and of itself, they see you hovering around in the corners of their eyes, and they kind of go, why is that guy just standing there? And while you're thinking, I'm nervous, I just want a chance to talk to you, they're thinking, he's just hanging around for no reason, staring at us, like he's measuring us up for a flesh suit.
that's one possibility.
So, yeah, you think that you're doing one thing, and how it's coming across is another. So you're being creepy by accident. You have the purest of intentions, but it's just that you're triggering that, like, danger instinct that women justifiably have.
So that's an interesting point, because I've always been curious about the people that we're talking about here aren't necessarily socially awkward at everything. This might just be like a particular blind spot is necessarily reading how women see the situation, perhaps.
Yeah, there's a lot to do with that. It's that women, unfortunately, have to deal with, you know, the background radiation of being a woman is that you're really more or less constantly threatened by men, and men represent potential danger no matter who they are, and you kind of have to feel them out. So their spidey sense is much higher and much more easily triggered than it is for guys. So a lot of stuff that guys think may not be that big of a deal can come off as threatening. Guys tend, for example, to, when we talk to somebody, we give them our full profile. We face them head on. We look them right in the eye. And that's how we're saying, I'm giving you my full attention. I consider what you're saying important. But when you're doing this to a woman, this can be really intimidating. It's kind of an aggressive move. So you're standing there just facing them full on and just staring them down. And that can be kind of what's going on through this guy's head, what's happening. You know, is he showing me how much bigger he is than me and can overpower me? So turning slightly to the side, pointing yourself away from them so they don't feel like you're cornering them, can really ease a lot of tension. Especially if you're talking to someone at a crowded venue, standing next to them, and then talking to them like facing both the same direction and talking to them over your shoulder can really make it feel a lot less intimidating than if you're just right in front of them. And especially if you accidentally back him into a corner, which is a big no-no.
And I feel like that's probably true for men's comfort as well, that, you know, from my understanding, that men feel more comfortable building intimacy and shared vulnerability when they are facing the same direction as the person that they're talking to. Like, you know, if you're both like climbing up a wall, or you're both sitting on a seat, or, you know, you're both walking forward, that sort of thing. It feels much, much safer, kind of like the level of intimacy that can be built from talking over the phone instead of in person in many ways.
It feels less, I would say less confrontational, but I think there's a certain amount of like just kind of fear of emotional vulnerability. So when you're not actually looking at somebody, it's easier to, for guys at least, to admit, you know, having feelings.
And I'm so glad that I'm hearing this from you, from a guy specifically. And I feel that women can say this stuff to men. And sometimes the reaction that I've personally gotten from having this sort of conversation with someone is that they say, no, you females are responsible for your feelings. And if you feel creeped out and you feel, you know, aggressed upon, that's for you to control. It's not, you know, people can look wherever they look, you know, that's up to them. They can talk to whoever they want to. You're responsible for your reaction. And I mean, that is not true. But I think it does, exactly as you said, it totally takes out of the equation the fact that, you know, I literally don't know if this guy is friendly or if he's a complete fucking psychopath. And if I mess up, it's not a small deal.
Yeah. And really, when they say stuff like that, it's like, hey, it's on you to control your emotions. What they're saying subtextually is, my right to talk to you, my right to hit on you, my right to try to get you to go home and fuck me is greater than your right to your own safety and comfort. And that's really just, again, that's not a place where you want to be coming from if you're trying to actually interact with them from a positive place.
So, I mean, that's...
So that's where the creepy comes in. So you're saying that my will should overpower yours because I just want it.
So when you're talking to your audience and to men about this sort of stuff, do you encounter the kind of resistance that women do when they say this kind of information, this kind of advice?
I get a little from people who don't necessarily feel like they should have to change or to moderate their behavior, but I don't get nearly as much pushback as women who say the same thing do. And that's something I try to keep aware of, because whenever I talk about anything that starts dipping into feminist issues, whether it's I did a post called Nerds and Male Privilege, talking about the way that like women are treated in the geek fandom, I get a lot less pushback than someone who said the same thing, and usually better than I did does. Like if I wrote about, you know, the sexist way that women are treated in games, I'll get, you know, some debate, some controversy or whatever, but I don't get the reaction that Anita Sarkeesian got.
Oof.
Like nobody's out there vandalizing my website or creating a, you know, beat up Dr. Nerdlove game, or, you know, going through and giving me a Wikipedia page of nothing but porn pics.
Or rape threats also.
Yeah. it's the unfortunate benefit of being a guy that I don't get that level of treatment. And it's also unfortunate that people give my words more weight by virtue of my gender when other people are out there saying it too. And to be perfectly honest, often saying it better.
So what prompted you to go into this field? Why did you decide to share this advice with the world?
Well, I started off as most of my readers have. Like every flaw they've had in dealing with women, I've had first and probably worse. And I eventually found my way because I got tired of just not knowing what I was doing when it came to relationships, when it came to finding sex partners, girlfriends, whatever. Eventually found my way to the pickup community. And I learned a lot there, not the least of which being how much of it was bad for me and how much I didn't like the person I was becoming while I was part of it. So eventually I found my way out of the community and really wanted to sort of find ways of integrating the good stuff that I learned without necessarily the toxic aspects that came with it. And during all of this, I was on a podcast that was part of Spill.com called The League of Extremely Ordinary Gentlemen. And amongst my friends, I had gotten the reputation of being, you know, Mr. Saturday Night, Mr. Player, the guy who was always going down every weekend and like having amazing adventures. So when we did an episode on Scott Pilgrim versus the World, we invited people to write in their stories of their evil exes or the girls they tried to get together with. And as they sent in their questions, we started answering them. They kind of turned to me as the guest expert. Then a little while later, we had the February 14th Valentine's Day episode where we did sort of a reprise and said, all right, you know, send in your love questions for Dr. Nerdlove. This was where the nickname came from. And I didn't get to all of their questions, and I felt kind of bad about it. So I recorded a quick video to put up on the League of Extremely Ordinary Gentlemen forums to answer some of the questions we didn't get to. And then people started sending in their questions to that forum, and I would answer them there, and then eventually said, you know what, this is clearly a thing, and took it and created the blog.
So where are the places that you have learned the good stuff from? You said you'd originally started out a pickup, but then you clearly have added on top of that. So what are like sources that you find interesting and other ways that you've expanded your knowledge base?
Well, the pickup community actually does have a lot to offer in terms of good and neutral techniques, and most of it in the sense of learning how to interact with other people. But it's sometimes you get I think Clarice Thorne calls them the Darth Vader pickup artists in her book, Confessions of a Pickup Artist Chaser. So a lot of it was going in there and separating out the stuff that was really negative, like seeing what's known as the commercial model of sex, where women are valued only for the sex they don't have and set the quote-unquote market price. Mm-hmm. And men are supposed to negotiate down the market price to get it as cheap as possible, but a woman who becomes this weird, you know, supply and demand thing. The woman who supplies too much sex for too cheaply is considered a slut and is worthless, or as I've seen a couple of people call them, a rapidly devaluing asset. And that's, you know, getting away from that and getting to more of the collaborative model, where it's treated more like, you know, hey, here's this awesome thing I like to do. Here's what I bring to the table. What would you be interested in joining me in this, rather than what do I have to do, pay, say, whatever to get you in bed? And going from there. And a lot of it was understanding that women are sexual beings just like men are, rather than, you know, women are these beings of purity who only tolerate sex or who trade sex in exchange for protection, companionship, children, whatever. There's actually a really awesome book that only just came out a few months ago by Daniel Ellsberg, I believe. I may be getting his name wrong, but it's called What Do Women Want?
I was totally going to ask you about that book. That's so weird.
It is awesome. And it is, I think it should be required reading for just about everybody, but especially for men who want to get better with women. It's understanding that women are sexual too. In fact, often to a point that it would be intimidating to men. And once you understand that, you can become more able to recognize that it isn't about tricking or pressuring or, you know, seducing. It's about meeting, like finding someone, understanding them as a person, and wanting to do something, share something with them.
So, speaking of that book, one of the things that I found really huge about it was trying to remove the myth, destroy the myth, that women are not interested in sex or they only want sex to get relationships or that sort of thing. And just like, if that were remotely true, if that were a thing that had any basis in biology or anything, then why are there so many fucking strictures to prevent female sexuality? Like, why would you need to do everything from female genital mutilation to just, you know, keeping women covered to, you know, all of the stuff around female purity that is ultimately, you know, social control? Why would that exist if that wasn't a drive of women? It doesn't make any sense. Like, why would you need to put in protective measures if no such concern was actually there?
Yeah, and go and really the idea that women are less sexual than men is not that old at all. In fact, I think you can really start tracing it back to the Victorian era, and really with the revivalist movement within Protestant Christianity, where women were suddenly supposed to be, you know, the pure ones, the guardians of sexuality, and rescuing poor men from their bestiality, and, you know, pity them, for they know not what they do. They're mere animals, and complete surrender to their lust.
It is it's bizarre how much Victorian era ideas are currently influencing us. Like, I think it's really strange. It was like not the longest period. It wasn't like the most anything. It's just like bizarrely influenced everything. It's very strange.
Yeah, and back in the classic era, when in Greece and Rome, Ovid's Metamorphosis has a story of King Tiresias, who is called upon to settle a bet between Zeus and Hera over who has more pleasure during sex, men or women. And in the name of rigorous study, they turn him into a woman for 9 years. And at the end of it, he comes back and they say, okay, so how's it work? And he says, I think women not only have more pleasure in sex than men do, but I think they have more than 9 times the pleasure that men do.
That's interesting. There's also parallel stories that I've read from Mesopotamia and also from ancient Hindu script, that same basic idea, the same premise that, like, you know, it was usually like gods arguing about something. But yeah, why does this idea go away? It was so clearly like semi-universal if it's happening in such distant places.
Honestly, my guess would be a lot has to do with paternity. You can never be sure, at least up until we had blood tests, DNA checks, whatnot, who the father of a child was, but you could always be sure who the mother was. So you didn't, you know, when the continuation of your family line and your goods and your property is going to be going to your children, you want to make sure that they're actually your children and not that somebody put a, you know, metaphorical cuckoo in your nest. Mm-hmm. And to bring it into another book, Sex at Dawn by Christopher Ryan, talks about how a lot, we used to have much more open sexuality where sex was disconnected from relationships and was a way of forming emotional bonds and creating unity amongst the tribe, that went away when we discovered agriculture. And once we established that land was something that could be owned, that property could be owned, we established that other things could be owned as well, as including children. And if we're going to be passing the things we own to our children, we want to make sure that we own the mothers of our children so that they are just ours. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's where a lot of the roots of, you know, regulating female sexuality comes from.
We're talking about a lot of this through like sort of an evolutionary psych lens. And I find some pushback about evolutionary psych from, you know, a couple different paradigms, one being that it is ultimately like an unprovable science, and another one being that, of course, it comes often laden with sort of patriarchal notions of, you know, retrospectively applying patriarchal things on it. Do you have any sort of opinion on evolutionary psych or that sort of thing in general as a tool?
More often than not, when I've seen it applied, it's being applied by people who have very, like, low ideas about evolution and psychology. And like you said, I think a lot of times we're using it to back justify things that exist now and ignoring the social aspects of them. Like when people insist that, you know, men are naturally polygamous and women are naturally monogamous. And then they'll point to, say, chimpanzees, where male chimpanzees will have a harem of females, and the females are restricted to just that one male. But we're not really evolved from chimps. We're much closer, evolutionarily speaking, to bonobos, mm-hmm. where it's a female hierarchy, and there really is no sexual monogamy at all. Everybody is literally fucking everybody else, and for reasons ranging from gratitude to pleasure to bribery to it's Tuesday night, we've got nothing to do. What are you up to?
Yeah, I mean, I love bonobos. Who doesn't love bonobos? They've replaced violence with sex. It's great. I'm so happy. I love it. So this conversation also, I think, pertains to a little bit. We've talked about slut shaming. And, you know, I think that when people are discussing, like, why would women engage in slut shaming? And then there's that, exactly as you said before, the market depreciation argument that, like, if other women are, you know, giving away the goods for cheaper, you're going to have to also, or those women are competition for mates, etc. And I think my view on that argument is, you know, the critique I had of Evo Psych, that, you know, we're sort of retrospectively placing our own values on it. Because in my reading of females in history, we do much better when we collaborate. That, like, having women doing well is good for other women. That the best thing to happen for an individual woman is for other women to be succeeding. And so I find it interesting that this competition thing is sort of applied to women when I don't know if that's necessarily either historically true or, like, has any, like, biological or psychological basis. Do you have a thought on that?
Honestly, I think a lot of it is just absorbing the cultural narrative. Okay. And as a result, you end up with a lot of gender policing. I mean, guys do this too. Guys really, you know, every time a guy exposes too much emotion at inappropriate moments, you know, we're allowed to cry at Brian's song and when our dad dies, and that's it. So if a guy, you know, cries at a sad movie, everybody kind of looks at him and goes, fag. Or, so, you know, guys gender police themselves. We're not allowed to express our emotions. It's like you said earlier about feeling more enabled to be emotionally vulnerable with somebody when you're not actually facing them. So I think a lot of that just comes down to women. A lot of women have absorbed the message that women are this one way and one way only. And then they're, you know, gender policing themselves. So when a woman is having, you know, too much sex, she's seen as a slut. And we've got a lot of strictures in place, culturally, spiritually, and whatnot, that says you really are not supposed to question these. Like, I've gotten a lot of emails from readers, men and women, who have come from deeply religious, conservative backgrounds. That sometimes they've realized that they're gay. Sometimes they've escaped from abusive relationships and realized that, you know, I want to have sex, but I don't necessarily want to get married right now. And they always have that little voice in the back of their head that you know, they grew up with, saying, you're a bad person for doing this. This is wrong. This is sinful. And it's just that cultural narrative that just latches its teeth into us and is really hard to let go of.
So how much of your work in answering people's questions is specific advice building, specific advice giving and skill building? And how much of it is just normalizing, then, is just telling people, you know, you're okay as a human as you are, and you, that sort of thing?
Honestly, it's about 50-50. Okay. Sometimes it's cases of, you know, here's this thing you're doing wrong. You know, here, you want to say this instead of this, or you're not getting the results you want because you're not understanding how to generate chemistry. And other times it's saying these desires, these fears, these whatever you have, they're normal. You know, it's understandable that you have them. And you just need to be able to accept them and be able to express them in a way that's positive. And some people want to be, you know, are more inclined towards monogamy, and that's great. Some people are more inclined towards a more, like, not non-traditional monogamy. Dan Savage calls it monogamish, mm-hmm. where, you know, one person or both are let off the leash every once in a while, or coming to the understanding that, as much as we want to, one person can't be all things to our lovers. So there will always be desire for other people. And explaining that, no, that's perfectly normal. Monogamy is not, you know, monogamy is the cultural default. It is not the biological default. So you're always going to want other people. It's just up to you whether you act on that.
So it sounds like you are sort of doling out info on all different states. So it's not just like acquiring possible mates, but also like maintaining those relationships. Do you get maintenance questions as well?
Quite a few. And I think that's an important part, because just because you're good at getting relationships or sex doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be good at keeping them. That's actually one of the interesting parts of the game, where when you're reading it, you see that mystery great at picking chicks up, not so good at maintaining a relationship. And that's a really significant aspect of it that I think that, say, pickup doesn't tend to focus on. They focus much more on the go out, find, attract, you know, attract a mate, attract a partner, sleep with them, and whatever happens, happens. Whereas for a lot of people, it's I've got a girlfriend or I've got a boyfriend and I want to keep them happy. How do I do that?
It's a really interesting thing because they are totally different skill sets. It's kind of like, this is a weird analogy, but how, you know, the skills required to run for office are quite different than the skills required for actually being like a governor.
Yeah, we've got a lot of politicians who are great at running for office, but not so good at actually governing.
Yeah, and I think it's like the stuff that is shiny and is very, you know, like appealing to people initially when they don't know you may not necessarily be the best for sustaining long term. Although, I mean, I think there definitely is something to be said for, you know, not everybody wants to settle down. But I think that some folks go into perhaps the pickup scene thinking actually that is what they want. They want to find like one partner. But yeah, there's sort of like a dropping off, like this cliff you just fall off afterwards. And you're like, all right, I'm going to find another advice community.
Yeah, that's actually one of the problems I had with the pickup community is that they every time somebody got a girlfriend, it was treated as letting the side down.
Oh,
like
okay.
Why would you do that? There are so many other women. Why are you being a fool and letting yourself get tied to one vagina for the rest of your life? It's like, well, maybe because she makes me happier than anybody ever has, or can it's the person who's helping make all my dreams come true. Like, what's it to you? So yeah, a lot of guys get into pickup because they're looking for, sometimes it's, they've got the one girl they've had a crush on. I call it one-itis, when you believe that they are the one, capital T, capital O. And that's a problem in and of itself. And other times it's just that they want to find a girlfriend, a wife, a life partner of some sort, and just don't know how to go about doing it. And some people are completely socially awkward and have never so much as kissed a girl. Some have had some success, but can't really break down what they've done right or what they've done wrong, and they would like more of a structured idea. And then there are the people who just want to have lots of sex, and more power to them. It's just that it's all part of a continuum, and just being good at getting sex or getting dates may not be necessarily enough.
I've always been sort of curious about both pickup artists and like bartenders about what happens to them over the progression of time. The two are jobs or activities where I feel like there's a great deal of emphasis on youth relatedness to it. Like hot bartenders and like pickup artists tend to be pretty young, but like, you know, I don't see that many like super old bartenders, and I always wonder what happened to pickup artists too. Like what is the age range and what happens to most people? I mean, it hasn't been around. Like, Neil Strauss particularly isn't, like, super old. So, like, how long, what is the trajectory? Where do they plan to go?
It really depends. I mean, some people just drop out of the community, period. Some people get married. Some people try to form, like, poly relationships and use what they learn there. It's a little early to say, really, what the general arc is. The person who's generally accorded as the godfather of pickup, or at least the organized pickup community, is Ross Jeffries, who's in, I want to say, in his late 50s. And he's been around since the early 90s or so. In fact, in a lot of ways, the Tom Cruise's character in Magnolia was based on him.
Okay.
So he's out there, and admittedly, he's kind of, well, the creepy, dirty old man, because he teaches the hypnosis version of pickup, where you hypnotize the women into blowing you, because that's not creepy at all.
Wait, literal hypnosis?
Yeah, he does a version of neuro-linguistic programming, where you're supposed to anchor commands and emotional states into specific words or into activities so that they associate it with you, and you end up with people saying things like really awkward phrases like, you think these thoughts are coming from above you, but really they're coming from below me.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So, you can tell pretty quickly when you're talking to one of those guys.
And So now that's reminding me less of Tom Cruise from Magnolia and more of like Will Ferrell in Wedding Crashers.
There is a, yeah, Wedding Crashers is a popular movie with them. And there's actually a lot of crossover in that, because a lot of the stuff they do is similar, if not taken directly from, say, Mystery Method, where they're creating, you know, emotional engagement with the women they're meeting. And, you know, it's a mix of emotional engagement, physical chemistry, showing them that they're these awesome guys and kind of getting them all, you know, revved up. And then, well, there we go. Sex happens.
And I just want to put out there to anybody who's listening that I don't want to say that I'm like shitting on the pickup artist community either, as much as I love poking at it. I actually went as Mystery for Halloween one year in like 2008.
Awesome.
Yeah, it went pretty well. Yeah, it chicks dug it.
That is so cool.
I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the one-itis, about mm-hmm. that concept. Can you speak to that a little bit more?
Sure. It's basically the idea that this one person, girls get it too, is the one, the capital T, capital O, the most specialist, bestest cookie in the package. You will never find anyone who is as beautiful, as attractive, as wonderful, as whatever as they are. Sometimes it's someone who you love from afar. Sometimes it's an ex. I had a nasty case of one-itis after a woman that I thought was my perfect relationship dumped me. And it took me a long time to get over her, way longer than it should have, because I had convinced myself she was the one, instead of understanding that there is no the one. There's no one soulmate. There are lots of the ones. And more often than not, what it really is you find, you know, a 0.87 and round them up to the one.
Okay.
But when you get hung up on the idea of this person is the one and I will never do any better or never find anyone who equals them, then you're cutting yourself off from, you know, the millions and millions of other people who are out there who are just as, if not possibly more wonderful than they are.
So how much of this is a, like, sort of that spiritual soulmate-y, like, we were split in half and we have to go find our other half, versus how much of it is a sort of self-deprecating idea that you can't do better?
Both, really. Okay. We live in a world where we've gotten the narrative that there is this one perfect person out there for you, and you need to find them. And so, that seems to be the message of just about 90% of our pop culture, from Disney movies to romantic comedies and whatnot. And then there's also a lot of people who are just kind of like, no one could ever possibly love me, so I need to hold on to you with, you know, both hands and possibly teeth as well.
Aww.
Which was admittedly part of in my case what my problem was. I was dealing with severe low self-esteem. It was like, okay, not only was she, you know, was she perfect, she was gorgeous, she was geeky, she was, you know, into the same things I was, but also she was into me, and that happened so rarely. I can't possibly imagine a time when this might happen again.
Interesting.
And it's not exactly a case of you're only as loyal as your options, but it's, you know, it's, you're creating a scarcity mindset where every time you get shut down by somebody or shot down or rejected, you're just one step closer to dying alone and unloved, forgotten, and, you know, nobody caring. When reality, you know, the mentality that people really need to pick up is there are literally millions of single men and women in the world. Most of them are really awesome. And just because you found one that didn't work doesn't mean that you're doomed forever to be a forever alone character. You just have to find the ones who do work for you.
This is interesting, because it seems like that would be the other end of the spectrum from what it's like many people have expressed, you know, dating in a big city, it's trying to be an ember in the middle of a fire. And like, how are you supposed to date anybody when there are limitless options around you, which would be like the other problem on the other end of the spectrum, is that you can't decide because there's this perception that, you know, you could still better deal. You could, you know, get a slightly better product for your money kind of idea.
Yeah. And I can understand that, but at the same time, sometimes you just have to go with, this person makes me happy, period. Dan Savage, who I refer to as my celebrity spirit animal or celebrity Patronus, depending on the mood I'm in, has the phrase, settling down means settling for. And, you know, it's just the understanding that no one out there is going to hit 100% of your wants. And if you keep looking for the person who's that 100%, you're going to miss out on the 75%, the 80%, the 85% who are right there. And so you're missing out on the good because you're looking for the perfect.
Hmm. So how do you find like the sort of happy medium between all of these different things? And people are coming to you for advice on getting women, keeping women, etc. And how do you keep it from, you know, you have to apply this so generally to so many people. So there's going to be some folks where they might be overshooting. I don't know how I feel about the whole out of someone's league idea, but like, how do you broadly talk to such a wide variety of people who might have so many different errors, I guess, in why they're not finding success?
There are a wide variety of errors, but I find that there are a lot that come up more than others.
Okay.
So if I can take down, you know, help people with the 80% that crop up the most often, that's a lot, you know, that's covering a lot of territory. And from there, if it's something really, really granular, something really specific, you know, I can address that on more of an individual level. But a lot of times you just have to shoot for as wide of a mark as possible. So I, like, guys have a hard time with chemistry because we're taught that chemistry is either there or it's not. And so they don't understand necessarily that you can create chemistry. So I'll teach that. Whereas someone who's got, you know, some very specific issue can be a little, you know, it's worth taking on, like, on an individual level, especially if it comes in on a question. But it's, again, something that really is only helping one person as opposed to as many as possible. And sometimes that's just the decisions you have to make.
All right. So a couple more questions for you about the kind of questions that you get. So my first one is, what is the weirdest question you've ever gotten or that you can remember right offhand?
Fortunately, I haven't gotten too many really, like, completely outre ones. I've gotten some that are just kind of, I want to date a girl who's in a wheelchair. Where do I find them?
Huh.
So that one was an interesting one. And there's actually a lot of people who are into, you know, handicapped men and women. I think they're called
devotees.
There's a phrase for it that I'm drawing a blank on. But it's
I think it's
there's actually a community of that out there. And it's interesting because it's one of those times of, sometimes it's just, you know, we say they're fetishizing someone, and a lot of times fetishization can be bad, especially when you get into, right, to say, race fetish. Mm-hmm. But, you know, humans are complex, and sometimes I'm not just a person with feelings. I'm a piece of meat, and I want to be used.
Do you think that that's sustainable? That's a, like, kind of a side question from that. Like, so let's say somebody writes you about, like, specifically women in wheelchairs is incredibly attractive to me. Do you think that that's, I mean, because that could be bad, because then it's ultimately not about the person, it's about, like, some facet of them. But, like, is that any more superficial than any other thing that initially compels you towards someone?
Well, it's like with race fetishism, say, or wheelchairs. A lot of it depends on whether it's an interest or a requisite. Like, are you interested in somebody and this other aspect of them, that, you know, they're East Asian, or that they're a redhead, or that they're in a wheelchair, is that a bonus or is that a prerequisite? Like, when people are really into race fetish, especially, say, guys who are into Asian girls, they're not usually into a woman who happens to be Asian. They're into the stereotype of Asian women, which 9 times out of 10 has absolutely nothing to do with real women. It's just this fantasy they have in their heads. That's not sustainable. That's really insulting. You're trying to screw a collection of stereotypes rather than a person.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody who is really into redheads or has a thing for foreign accents and can find other people attractive even without it, then, you know, it's less of a, you know, wanting to have that particular stereotype and much more of a, well, this is an added bonus.
That kind of reminded me of a friend who went to Australia on her study abroad. And, you know, if you have a thing for Australian accents and then you go to Australia for study abroad, you're going to win the lottery is the answer.
Yeah. It's like Irish accents in the U.S. It's different than exotic. And so it's infinitely intriguing. I think there's actually some theory that that's how blonde hair kind of evolved, even though it tends to be a recessive gene, is that it's so intriguing because it's so uncommon that a lot of people were much more attracted to it.
Well, there's that, and then there's also the fact that blonde hair is so intricately tied to youth, because most people, even natural blondes, tend to go darker with age, and so features like blonde hair and any other like physical trait that goes away with time is attractive innately for that sort of signifier as well. That's another another component of it. I have another question for you about did you have anything else on that? I'm sorry.
No, actually, I think that was all of it.
Okay. So the other question I had. So aside from your metaphysics degree, like, do you ever get any questions that you feel like are outside of your realm, like that you need to turn elsewhere to like look up the answers for?
On occasion, yeah. And when that happens, I try to find somebody else who can give some better advice than I can. One that I had just recently was a young woman who is a sex worker. She's a masseuse who gives happy endings, and wanted to know about, can she still be a sex worker and still date and have actual relationships without having to lie to her partners? And I've only got the outsider's view and can only take the stance of, well, how would I, someone who is sex positive and pro-sex work, feel if my girlfriend or my wife suddenly revealed to me, it's like, oh, and by the way, I used to, jerk off guys for money. And I had to admit, like, even as someone who is pro-sex work, I was like, I don't know how comfortable I would be with that. So I gave my advice as best as I could, with the understanding of, like, there is certain social stigma and there will be people who will automatically judge you for this. And these are there by doing so, they're self-selecting out of your dating pool. But I wasn't happy with the limits of my experience. So I reached out to Mistress Matisse, who is a pro-dom and a columnist at The Slog in Seattle, and said, hey, I've got this question from one of my readers, and I think, you might have much better perspective on this than I would. And she was generous and kind enough to write back and say, here you go, here's what I would say to this person. And I was able to add that to the column.
What was her advice?
A lot of it was the same. It was just that you're going to have to be very careful about the people you confess that your job to, because there's such stigma around it. And if it's not going to be what you're doing for the rest of your life, it could cause problems if you have a vengeful ex. There have been a lot of people who've been sex workers who've been forcibly outed by abusive exes, or through well-meaning people who said, hey, everyone needs to know that you do this. And to also watch out for the white knights, the guys who are going to try to save you from all of this, rather than realizing that, like, no, you're actually cool. This, you don't need saving. You haven't been damaged. This is just a job you do because because it's an extension of your sexuality. And yeah, having someone who actually works in the industry, in this case, as a pro-dom, was a big plus, because she had perspective and experience that I could never have.
Awesome. So, obviously you're cool and people should find out more about you. So how do people find out more about you?
Well, the blog is Dr. Nerdlove, Dr. D-O-C-T-O-R, Nerdlove, all one word. If they want to follow me on Twitter, it's at Dr. Nerdlove, and I can be found with the Nerdlove Facebook page on facebook.com/Dr. Nerdlove.
Awesome. So any other suggestions stuff they should check out? You have any events or specific things that you want them to know about?
I've got some interesting stuff coming up in the future, but at the moment it's one of those, don't want to, I'm kind of superstitious, so if I talk about it before papers are signed or whatnot, then I worry that it'll disappear.
I dig it.
So keep checking on the Facebook page and the Twitter feed, and it'll hopefully be coming out pretty soon.
If they like you and they follow you, they'll find out about it when they're supposed to.
Yes, indeed. And also the Dr. Nerdlove podcast is coming back very, very soon.
Yay! Awesome. So thank you so much for being on today.
Thank you for having me. I had a blast.
Yay. And thank you, everybody, for listening, and have an awesome day. Thank you for listening to Sex with Timmery. Sex with Timmery, the podcast, is produced by Nathan Karuna. Our opening music is by Charles Evans. Our closing music is by Hanya Lee. Be sure to check out sexwithtimmery.com, Sex with Timmery on Facebook, and tweet at me, Timmery_LEIGH. If you're a fan of the show, if you like it at all, a little bit maybe even, rate and review us on iTunes and tell your friends all about it. And thank you.